Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Things Therapy. I am Lisa Tahir, your host. I am a licensed clinical social worker practicing as an intuitive psychotherapist. I'm certified in both Reiki and EMDR. I have physical offices in both Los Angeles and New Orleans. You can stay current on things going on through my website, which is nolatherapy.com. It's the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy. You can book sessions, email me, inquire about being a guest on this show, and I'll feature things coming up in the future. Like on February 21st, I will be a guest on Living Consciously cable TV show. So more to come about that. And you can also subscribe to this show to hear past episodes and future episodes on YouTube, Google Play, and iTunes. So I'm really pleased to bring my guest on in just a moment. It's such an honor to have on Dr. Irving Polster. He is currently director of the Gestalt Training Center in San Diego. He has authored 6 books to date, and today we're going to be speaking about his most recent book, which is called Beyond Therapy, Igniting Life-Focused Community Movements. And him and he and his late wife, Miriam, have been instrumental in advancing Gestalt therapy to where it's utilized today in mainstream psychotherapy. And his career spans since 1946. And most of you listening probably know about the empty chair technique, where you would speak to someone as if they were in the room. Well, Dr. Polster helped to create this and other awareness process techniques. So, Dr. Polster, please come on the show, and thank you for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I'm glad to be here.
You're welcome. So, where would you like to start?
Am I speaking loudly enough?
Yeah, you're great.
Okay.
We're great. So, where would you like to start today with your work with Gestalt therapy?
I suppose a good way to start would be to give some sense of why we would want to extend the principles of psychotherapy beyond the actual therapy. We know that psychotherapy has been a means for helping people who are in misery, and Freud long ago discovered that if you pay attention to your life correctly, with the right proportion and the right attention, that it would help to improve lives, and that was the basis for psychotherapy. The psychotherapy has become very well known in our society, but what is not as well recognized is that the principles of psychotherapy apply to people in everyday life and are not limited to whether or not you have some acute problem or some acute disturbance. So what I'm trying to do is to present the prospects for a method of paying attention to the lives we live that will apply to people at large and help them to live the best lives they can live.
To help clients become more fully alive and to
right, that's a good way to put it. Yes, yes.
Work on unfinished business to bring it resolution. And so, Dr. Polster, what you don't know, and for our listeners, we had some technological difficulty. So I know Gestalt therapy is about being in the moment and the meta communication. I feel a little anxious right now because all technology failed, and thank goodness it just got started. So I'm a little off. So in a few moments,
well,
I'll settle
nice.
In.
It's actually nice to know that technology is human also.
It is. It is. And so we didn't get to chat before the show, which I usually do with each guest. I actually have an audio clip to play at some point of a 36-second clip of Dr. Fritz Perls, who you worked with, and an audio clip of you working with a client. When we get into talking more about the awareness process of, yeah, of Gestalt. So I'm settling into our show. I apologize for being a little freaked out. I just didn't expect technology to fail. So here we are.
Well, what is the failure? Are we communicating to people?
No, we're good. We're live listening? Now. We're live. I'm just used to having you with me 10 minutes before to have a little chit chat. So I'm a little thrown off.
I get it.
So tell me about, your career spans since 1946. You have worked with thousands of clients. You have helped people to actualize based on experiencing the present moment and heightening that awareness. What would you like listeners to know about today?
Well, first of all, most of my work over those years was in a private office and was oriented to, in a quasi-medical way, toward helping people in trouble. And
okay,
what I'm talking about now is something that would apply to people at large and would enter into everyday living, everyday morality, everyday belonging, everyday understanding of what life is about, and so on, much as people of religion orient people to those same questions with religious principles. Only what I'm talking about are principles discovered through the psychotherapy process.
And so the message of your book would be what?
Well, the method would be to form congregations of people who would meet regularly over an extended period of time and who would address certain themes that matter most in their lives, themes such as ambition, disappointment, home, contradiction of purpose, what is life about, how can we depend on each other. There are a number of live issues that people deal with every day and deal with privately and in their own particular ways, but which would be examined in a congregation of people led by psychologically trained people who had some background in knowing the implications of all of these particular states of mind.
Okay. So I'm hearing you want to affect positive change at a macro level with people going inward,
Yes, I one of the purposes is to effect change, but that's not the primary purpose. The primary purpose is to effect awareness and illumination about life, a kind of sense of perspective about living, and a way of improving particular ways of understanding ourselves.
Right. So what I like about your work, and I'd like to play the audio clips in just a few moments, is that when you are doing therapy, and I'll play a clip of you in session, you really bring to life not so much what is being said, the story, but the mannerisms. If someone's fidgeting with their hands, if someone, what the experience is. And that's why I felt comfortable sharing with you my nervousness coming on live. I'm used to having 10 minutes with my guest, feeling very relaxed, and that didn't happen. And so I'm having to, deal with the adrenaline surges and calm myself down in this moment. And that's what Gestalt, that's what a Gestalt is. It's bringing the current moment alive, correct? For our listeners.
Well, it's a lot more than, mannerisms and such. It's a matter of being faithful to the complexity of our lives and being able to say what we want to say and do what we want to do and understand the implications and deal with the consequences and develop a life that is worth living and feels like it's what we want.
Living authentically is what I hear you saying.
Well, authentically, that's one of the catchwords about this process, yes. Authentically only means that it's honest and it's straightforward and it's directed toward specific things that are necessary for living.
Enlightenment. I'm thinking enlightenment too, personal enlightenment.
Enlightenment is a very good word and a well-known word for what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. So may I play the two clips right now for our listening audience? Okay, for those listening, this is Dr. Fritz Perls, who founded the Gestalt Therapy movement, which you and your late wife worked with. So here we go. I'm going to play this 36-second clip.
And start always a Gestalt therapy. The idea, where are you? Where are you in time? Where are you in place? Are you all there? Or are you at home attending to some unfinished business? And where are you in your awareness? Are you in touch with the world? Are you in touch with yourself? Are you in touch with this middle zone, the fantasy life, that is then interfering with the being completely in touch with yourself or the world?
Does that bring anything to mind for you?
Well, of course, Perls was a master at evoking awareness and made awareness a very popular term in our society. And I think that's very important, but it is it's only one aspect of living, and awareness itself is insufficient. That awareness always has to be integrated with action.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be integrated with relationship. It has to be integrated with purpose. And all of that makes it all the more complex. But awareness is a fundamental ground from which all these other things have to evolve.
And as I hear you say that, I'm thinking what interesting laboratories relationships are.
What interesting laboratory what?
Relationships are. That I think relationships are such interesting laboratories for us and for growth and bringing things up that might have been hidden.
Well, relationship is one of the fundamental innate drives that people have.
Right.
We all are driven toward relationship, whether we like it or we don't like it. We are, by our own biology, drawn toward otherness and integrating with otherness. We have to. We can do it in a million different ways and at many levels of intensity or success, but do it we must one way or another.
Yes. So how is your approach different from conventional psychotherapy?
Well, conventional psychotherapy has many faces. There are many, many forms of psychotherapy. It was at the time that it was introduced into our psychological culture, it was an antidote to the Freudian system of emphasizing why we're doing things and wanted to go into a person's actual experience more than the reasons for the experience. So that was one of the fundamental differences that Gestalt therapy offered at the time that it came onto the scene, and it served as a contrast to the Freudian emphasis on meaning.
Right. So you, in your book, life focus is a topic that you bring up. Can you share with us about life focus and what you mean by that?
Yes. Well, I'm thinking of one group meeting where the theme for the meeting was home.
Okay.
And what we did was to read a poetic segment that related to the concept of home, and then have people break into smaller groups of three or four, and after they formed their groups, we played a lovely song about someone having come home to Tanzania, a beautiful music that inspired people to drink in the idea of home.
Okay.
And then they talked to each other about what home meant to them. And one woman I remember spoke about the fact that she came from Poland to America, married someone who had visited in Poland, but required him to promise that she would be, when she died, she would be buried back home.
Okay.
And she told us a story of what that was like, to feel that connection with her life back home, even though she was living in the United States. And as the years went on, she became less and less concerned with being back home, but it always remained a force in her life and a grounding for everything that she knew, and everything was built on her idea of home. Well, that was one view of home, but other people had different views of home. And each of them expounded what their feeling of home was, and they had a sense of the differences that home meant to different people, while at the same time knowing that home was a universal idea,
right,
and that everybody had some concern with home one way or another. Some people said they had no home, and they wound up talking about different ways that they experienced what other people experience as home. They didn't call home, but actually it served the same kind of purpose.
It sounds, I think of the notion of nostalgia as I hear you talk about that story. Just nostalgia being a part of identifying what home is.
Yes, I think nostalgia would be one of the instruments of connecting with home.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about in your book, too, about the compelling need for people to join together to focus on how they are living their lives.
Yes. I think we are all formed by being individual and being communal. And we can't drop off either part of that formula. We are individuals, but we crave being a part of a larger unit. And
yeah.
People do that. They create that in their own lives in many ways. They feel like they belong in a neighborhood or a country or a family or a friendship or a club, a profession. There are so many different ways in which we feel we are part of something larger than ourselves. And, of course, there are many people who are interested in questions of ourselves beyond what we know as an earthly function. I don't go into that in the way that religion does, but I do believe that that's a fundamental need of people,
yeah,
to have a sense of where they fit into the universe.
Yes. Yeah, beyond the earth plane and the physical here and now.
Yeah.
In whatever way
the here and now is a sloganistic sense of what's important in life, but it ignores the fact that the here and now can exist only in the context of a lifetime.
Right.
The here and now doesn't mean anything if it doesn't fit into something larger.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be able to coordinate the here and now with a larger experience of our lives.
Yes. You know, I know that today I have a lot of therapists and healers listening to our episode. And for me as a therapist, I've practiced 20 years, and I'm really compelled about the way you really work, you know, in the room with your clients and the way you highlight things. So I wondered if I could play this clip. It's a bit of a departure from what we're talking about, but I know that some of those listeners,
sure,
are on wanting to know
all
about
right.
this. So I'm going to
yeah.
play. It's about a 1 minute clip. Here we go. And this
right
is
on.
Of you.
I'm interested in your stupidity and in your silliness. Don't you want me to be interested in the truth about you?
There's nothing interesting to this.
To you. There's nothing interesting to you in it. But to me, it's very interesting. Do you know the difference between you and me?
Not really.
Look how you're smiling now. Now you think that's silly? It's beautiful.
No, I'm smiling for a second. So what?
You're so ambitious. You want some second to become a minute and a minute to become an hour, and you haven't even let the second happen. You won't even join me in the fact that you smiled beautifully.
It doesn't
Can you
change.
Enjoy it? No, it won't change anything. I'm not interested in changing you. I'm interested in knowing you. I'm interested in being with you. I'm not interested in changing you. I want to discover you.
So before I heard that, Dr. Polsner, I was speaking with someone last night on a personal level, and I found myself saying something like, I wanted to create a shared environment for us to share our true selves, and I just wanted to know you and have this experience of being known. And, I come home and I find this clip. So I wonder if you could talk to us about this, about what I just played.
Well, one of the things that happens when people create a shortfall in their lives by cutting out a lot of experiences, and this particular person did that a lot. The problem is, how can you reincorporate what you already have, since the person who has shut out very important parts of their lives can't see that it creates what they need. They just obliterate parts of themselves that are valuable.
Yes.
Because they haven't got something else that they need. So there's a way in which people will very often think only this or that is important. If I can't have this or that, nothing else matters.
Okay.
But actually, you have to discover that other things do matter. You have to discover what actually does matter, and that may happen, the mattering may happen, even though you haven't yet gotten something you are seeing as the main ingredient of what you need.
Okay.
So the problem is, how can you discover the reality of your existence, even though it may not fit your ambitions?
So how do we do that?
Well, in the case of this particular person, a very tiny part of it was at least discovering a smile that was his smile. I didn't paint his smile on. He did it. I only noticed it. But he was unwilling to accept that he had it. It would have been an affirmation of small aspect of relationship with me, which he was not willing to accept at that time. He was later on willing to accept it.
And then he minimized it too when he said it's only a second, it's not going to change anything, like I think so many people do, minimizing what feelings that is going on.
Yeah. One of the important things in therapy is for people to accept things as they are, even though they may not be all that they want them to be. But things are as they are. And if you can do that in succession over a period of time, they become something more. And they may become what you originally wanted, even though that was not evident in the beginning.
I think that's such an important piece that you're bringing up, just letting things be as they are. And how difficult that is, to let things be as they are. It's such a challenge, I think, at times, when experience goes differently than what we'd like.
Well, if you've been severely punished by your father, let's say, and you have a permanent grudge about that, and then you smile with somebody else, and that it's almost a form of forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't a forgiveness of father; it's an acceptance of, in this case, it was me.
Right.
Why not accept that he smiled with me, even though he may not want to smile with his father?
Yes. And bringing that into the consciousness of the room.
Yes. It's a reincorporation of what's already there and that has been diminished by the way we feel about it.
Yeah. So how have you, and do you still work directly with clients at this point?
No, I don't. No.
Okay.
No, I have to tell you. No, I retired from my private practice almost 20 years ago. I'm 94 years old now.
Amazing.
And, so I don't do any of that, but I still do a number of things. I'm going to be presenting at a brief therapy conference next week. And
okay.
So I do occasional things, but not very much.
Okay. So his
Except
writing...
I did write the book that was published within the past year or so.
Yes. And then I'll
ask that book contains a lot of what I'm thinking about nowadays, and
yeah.
It's available on Amazon and probably Barnes & Noble also.
It is on Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com, Beyond Therapy, Igniting Life-Focused Community Movements. What sparked you to write this book in comparison to the other ones that you have written previously?
Well, I have to say that I was interested in the public utilization of psychotherapy a long time ago, and then my career went in a different direction and I concentrated on other things and I left it behind. But in the 1960s, I formed a group in a coffee house,
mm-hmm.
where the people who came to the coffee house were young folks. It was near college at Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and we had weekly meetings. We called them Encounter, and dealt
yeah.
with some of the issues of that young group of people, the issues they had with their teachers, with the police, with the society, and we would discuss them in the coffee house.
So you did a lot of group experiential work.
Well, I did. I also did a joint leadership with a rabbi in Cleveland, where we would meet with the group. They would go over the evening services that the rabbi would perform, and during the services, of course, religious services all have some content to them. We would go over the content as it related to each of their individual lives, which doesn't usually happen in religion. You say prayers about gratitude for this or that, for example,
right.
But you just say it for a moment, but you don't deal with your own experience with gratitude. Well, we did deal with the experiences of each person in relation to the things that they had said in the liturgy.
It was a very
enlightening experience.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was enlightening in terms of making the liturgy come alive in terms of their personal lives.
That's really cool. I'm curious what that actually looked like. Was it each person sharing their experience in the context?
Yeah, we were a group of about 10 people, and it was long ago, so I don't remember much
right,
of the detail.
Right.
But it was enlightening to them to relate the religious service to their actual lives, making the service, the liturgy, less abstract
yeah.
and more pertinent to what mattered to them.
Exactly.
But then I left Cleveland shortly after that to come to San Diego, and I didn't continue with that. So, but I did in those days. I taught for a short period at Overland School of Theology.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved to Vanderbilt, so I didn't teach there anymore. But I was teaching the interrelationship between religion and psychotherapy.
Oh, that's so interesting, Dr. Polster.
Well, I enjoyed it, and I I went in a different direction during my career, but in this last book I've returned to that concept, and I've developed it in a way that relates to what I have called in the book. I've called it the focus revolution. There's a movement out there in this world that is going on every day, that's very deep and very extended, and it gets very little. There's very little public knowledge about it, and it includes the mindfulness programs, the meditation. Right. It includes Alcoholics Anonymous. It includes religious relational groups in religion. It includes organizational groups that deal with how work can be a more productive place and a more satisfying place. And even, I must say, it's brand new, but there's an incredible attention to how we live our lives represented in Facebook. Okay. Now, Facebook is a pretty chaotic phenomenon. Huh. And some of it serves people well, and some serves them very poorly, I think. And it's pretty anarchistic in the sense of not having leadership or continuity in terms of specifics of what it takes to live a good life. So, but so that while I'm not, I'm very dubious about some aspects of the Facebook type of phenomenon, I think it's an incredible entry into recognizing that people need to talk to each other about their lives.
Yeah, as in the example of Facebook, there are over 600 million people registered on Facebook.
That's right.
So clearly,
what do you make of that? I mean, you know, and all they're doing is talking to each other about their lives.
Right. Well, that's why, to me, the audio clip that I just played really stood out to me, because I think one of our greatest need is to be seen and to be heard, especially. I mean, you can be seen, but that doesn't mean you're being taken in and absorbed and really being seen. I think Facebook is an offshoot of this deep desire that we have in our culture, you know, that isn't met adequately.
But I think it does need more form and more design and more recognition of the limits of human communication and what serves well and what serves destructively. There's very little of that entered into the process at this moment.
You know, and I think just going back to the focus revolution that you speak about in your book, as I'm appreciating it, like a heightened sense of sharpening your focus, utilizing your breath, for example, to really tune in to the moment. Would that be accurate for our listeners to know?
That would be a part of it, yes.
And I think something like Facebook can really distract us from that focus.
What I started to say is that there's this incredible movement out there that is given very little recognition in terms of human needs for belonging, for congregation, for being able to direct their attention to the things that matter in their lives. We have to understand that when each person is faced with an incredible sweep of experience every moment of every day of their lives.
Right.
And that we as people in relation to that sweep of experience have to do something to coordinate it. We make selections from all that happens, and we find there are all kinds of contradictions that happen, things that we don't know what to do with, and there's a lot that goes into the hidden background that doesn't get a chance to become expressed. I refer to it as the accessible hidden. And in these groups, we evoke the accessible hidden so people can tell the stories of their experiences that reflect how they see their lives and give hints about how their lives could go forward.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just, again, fascinated how much of your work is in the context of group settings and these kind of encounter groups. Myself, coming up as a therapist in the last 20 years, there's been more focus on the individual. And I think you're able to gain some unique information from these group process experiences that one doesn't get with individuals.
Yes. Well, at the same time that this focus revolution is happening out there, there's also an increase in actual therapy. And I think the therapy that is being done is very important in our society. I'm not diminishing the importance of therapy,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's a small factor when you compare it with the need for the society at large.
Yes. Yeah, I don't hear you diminishing psychotherapy at all. It's almost augmenting it with these other aspects that, you know, groups can bring.
But the thing is, when you talk about therapy, the word therapy means there's something wrong with you. And we have to get over that concept.
Yeah.
That these principles that we call therapy are not only for something being wrong with you, they are for how people live their lives. People as a whole require a central orientation and guidance in how to live their lives. Mm-hmm. Every society has it in one form or another. And one of the options for us is this large area of knowledge that we've gotten through explorations in psychotherapy that tell us about the things that drive people's minds.
You know, I know in researching a little bit about you and growing up in Cleveland, and I read that you were a doorman in a movie theater, I think in high school. Is that correct?
Well, that's right. I was in high school.
Yeah, and I bring this up only to highlight that that's where, in my understanding, you learned a sense of how people may be different from who we think they are. And I remember.
It was a very great eye-opener for me.
Yeah. And do you want to tell that story about being in the tough neighborhood and these kids?
Well, yeah. I was when I was 15, I became an usher in a certain movie theater. When I was 17, they advanced me to becoming a doorman in a different theater, but the theater was in one of the tough neighborhoods in Cleveland. So I went there and did my job there, but what I discovered there was a number of young guys who had been to reformatories, and I came from a very law-abiding atmosphere and environment, and I thought of people who were in reformatories as being some other breed of being.
Right.
But they weren't. These guys were fun. They were kind. Well, I'm sure they were not always kind, but they had these capabilities of human engagement, which were very enjoyable, and I was just stunned to discover that the set I had in my mind about what these folks would be like was quite different from what they actually were like.
Yes.
Then I took a course in juvenile delinquency in college, and that flipped my mind over into social work. And then after the war, I was during the Second World War. After the war, then I switched into psychology.
Yeah, you went from journalism to sociology and then grad school in psychology, I think.
My goodness, you know that.
I do. I love to know about my guests. And that's what I find so interesting. Like, if I may interpret or that, you know, what you learned as a young guy in high school about this curiosity and you know, who people present versus who they are has carried you through to age 96, I think, working with this theme in different and unique ways. That's been instrumental in my practice to learn from.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very good that you do that.
Thank you. So what we have like about 5 more minutes. I'm wondering, what would you like listeners, you know, to know, to leave us with and just a takeaway in thinking, just you've done so much in your career that you have to offer us?
Well, I would just like to say that we are We human beings are evolutionary beings, and we grow over the ages and the centuries. And I think we are growing into a people who are more and more oriented toward recognizing how we live our lives instead of just living them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very important evolutionary force that goes from the primitive taking things as they are and moving them into what they could be, and understanding that we are all influenced by factors that we can learn about instead of only guessing about.
Sure.
And I think it's a very noble process, and I think it has its ups and downs, but it's basic to our existence, and I think we're in a very developmental process of becoming some form of being that will take account of more things than we used to be able to take account of.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm including morality, too. These groups would be a source of development of morality. We have a morality now that that needs expansion and modification, that people have ways of being with each other that are quite different now than what they used to be. The whole idea of kindness or ambition or success, what's okay and what's not okay, is something that the people at large have a hand in designing. Mm-hmm. And these groups would be one force in doing that. Religion has done that, but you know, it has been said by some people in the psychological fields that psychology is the heir to religion.
Okay,
that's not to say that I'm not damning religion in that score at all. You know, religion has formed a tremendous orientation toward how to live your lives, and while there are some aspects of the religions as we know them that don't square with psychological principles, the fact is they've served an incredible purpose of enlightenment and guiding people and orienting them about how to live their lives. And psychology is coming along and has its ideas, and it ought to introduce them into the society at large rather than only into private offices.
You know, at the end of your book, Beyond Therapy, you talk about the supernatural influence and psychotherapy inducing a symbolic trust that measures up similarly to the symbolic trust of religion. And I'm really interested in the supernatural and where that boundary is, you know, between, say, therapy and the supernatural and the spiritual. Can you talk to us a little about that, what you were...
Well, I think the supernatural serves some very important human purposes, and I do spend a couple of chapters describing the overlap between the two, but there are some fundamental things that are human that are served by religion and by the supernatural that are also served in different ways by psychology. For example, sanctification. What I think of as I name four different ways that they're saying, but I can't go into all that right now.
Sure.
We don't have a moment. But
yeah.
The sanctification would be one factor. Sanctification to me is to have a place that's separate from everyday living, where the rules of everyday living don't dominate your mind. And when you go to religious services, it's like you're out of the world,
right,
into the world
of
the universe.
Right.
There's a depth and a beauty beyond the rigors of everyday living that we are embedded in when we go into a religious experience. And we need that. People need a way to get off the conveyor belt,
right,
and into some assured situation. And sanctification, psychotherapy, one of the main features of psychotherapy has always been when you come into that psychotherapy room, everything from outside world is most of it is no longer an admonition. It's no longer a barrier. You can say things you wouldn't say outside. You can feel things you wouldn't feel outside. You can remember things you wouldn't remember outside. And it's assured that you're going to be okay doing it because it's a sanctified situation. When you leave, you go back into the world. When you come back into the therapy room, you have the privacy of that engagement that allows you to be something other than you are in your everyday life. And I think
and
people
need
that.
Yes, we need the permission.
That's right. That's right.
In that space.
And we need that. And of course, God is a major representation of sanctification. Everything is okay with God.
Right.
I mean, God is beyond ordinary standards.
Morality.
God is, you know, forgiveness and understanding and context and so on and so on. There are different versions of God, of course. Can't go into all that right now, but what I'm saying is that it's a form of going beyond the ordinary everyday experience.
It is.
So that's one thing that both systems serve. And there are others, but we don't have the time for it right now.
Well, the last question I like to ask a guest, which might kind of dovetail into what you are saying, is what is it that you would like to leave, you know, the world be remembered for as a legacy, if you will, even?
Well, that somehow we find a way of being oriented toward life and guided in life together, to respect individuality while honoring the community, and find some way of coordinating those sometimes contradictory requirements, to be able to join the individual with the community and to honor both.
That's beautiful. So for listeners to reach you, I mean, your book, Beyond Therapy, is available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. I didn't see that you had a website per se, but you are director of the Gestalt Training Center in San Diego, where you have a profile about yourself.
Yeah, but I don't have a website, though.
Sure. So for people, just go online and purchase this book and then the other five, which are so interesting as well. The Population of Selves. I'm blanking on the other names right now.
Every Person's Life is Worth a Novel.
Gestalt Therapy Integrated, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Yes. Dr. Polster, has been such an honor to have you on my show because your work has been really instrumental for me. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. That concludes our show today. Join me next Thursday where I have another guest on. Same time, same place. Bye-bye.
You're listening to All Things Therapy.